You're listening to WRUU-LP, Savannah, Georgia, 107.5 FM, WRUU.org. We are Savannah Soundings, community radio with global soul.
Check, check, one, two. Look like a little country. Rock and roll and blues. Cause we sure love playing for good people like you. Let me know if you can hear me. Check, check, one, two.
You are listening to Savannah Music Local and Sustainable, the radio show that features conversations with and the music of local musicians and traveling musicians performing in town. I'm your host, Dave Lake. Tonight on Savannah Music Local and Sustainable, I have Rachel Barton Pine, who is completing the hat trick of my talk music programs, because in 2024, she appeared on Contemporary Classics with composer Earl Minean, talking about his violin concerto. In 2025, she appeared on Evening Eclectic with cellist Brandon Vamos of the Pacifica Quartet, talking about the music of French Impressionists. And tonight, we're here with harpsichordist Jory Vinicour, talking about Bach and Baroque music, and the fact that they will be both performing at the Bach Ascending Concert here in Savannah coming up this Sunday, February 15th at 4 p.m. at the Congregation Mikveh Israel on Monterey Square here in Savannah. Welcome to Savannah Music Local and Sustainable, Jory Vinicour, and welcome back, Rachel Barton Pine.
Wonderful to chat with you again. And Jory, you're in France at this moment.
I am. I'm sitting in my bureau and comfortably ensconced. And there we are. Yeah. And I'm leaving tomorrow towards the United States.
And I am home in Chicago before heading out to Rhode Island and then on to South Carolina and from there to Savannah. So,
absolutely.
Yeah, the amazingness of modern technology. We can all talk together.
Yes.
Well, we've had Rachel on a couple of times, as I've just indicated. So we've talked about her musical journey. But Jory, this is your first time. So tell us a little bit about your musical journey.
Oh, gosh. I mean, there's so much. A very important, hearty part of this involves Rachel. But I was, like Rachel, brought up in Chicago, studied piano with a very well-known Chicago-based teacher, Emilio Del Rosario, in high school, went off to Peabody Conservatory in Baltimore for my first college experience, very quickly became enamored of the harpsichord. And really, from the time I went off to college, I think I had the goal set in my mind to devote myself much more to the performance of Baroque and other early music on the harpsichord. This, of course, took a while. Went off, finished my degrees at Manus College of Music in New York City. From there, a couple years of postgraduate studies at Rutgers University in New Jersey, and then from there to France. And that's all the way back in 1990. So I have been principally in France pursuing my career as a harpsichordist in many different aspects since that time. And I mean, I should leave this to Rachel, but our paths came together again in the most fortuitous way, and we've been performing Bach programs together. Rachel, you probably know better than I do for how long. I think nearly 10 years.
And you together have performed on the album J.S. Bach, the Sonatas for Violin and Harpsichord, and that's on Sadie Records, and that was released back in 2018.
I think I initially reached out to Rachel when I was already living in France for some years. And I think she knew who I was. I knew who she was since she was a little girl, because she's a spectacular violinist from a very young age, and said, one day, if you have time, I would love to read some Bach with you. And, you know, this was, I don't know if you remember that letters used to be written with a pen and sent with stamps and envelopes. Do you recall these days?
And, indeed.
Because I think it was that, Rachel. I don't think this was email. I think I actually reached out to you first by the post. And then one day, Rachel said, sure, I would love to meet you. Met at a friend's house in Wilmette, Illinois. played Bach together. That was great. Next meeting a few years later, we got the Chicago Symphony to give us a room at a harpsichord. Rachel, if you remember that. And
Yes.
then it was you who reached out and saying, would you like to record the six sonatas for violin and obbligato harpsichord with me? And I thought about that for what must be 1/1000th of a millisecond and said yes while shouting, and there we are. So you say that was 2018.
Well, Jory's leaving out a bit of the story, which is that subsequent to our starting to have these Bach reading parties, he recorded the Goldberg variations, and I also got to see him perform them in live in concert. And of course, I'd been listening to others of his records, and I'd become a really big fan.
Oh,
And
wow.
so I knew that I always knew that I wanted to record the six violin and keyboard sonatas, which, when violinists talk of the six Bachs, of course, we mean the unaccompanied sonatas and partitas, and I had already recorded those. And as the Well, still the only American ever to have won the gold medal in the Bach International Competition in Leipzig. I thought, well, I really should record these and I love them. And, it just feels like something high up on my wish list. And I just knew that Jory was my number one choice for who I
Wow.
wanted to do them with. So, yeah, it was really a dream come true.
My head is exploding, Rachel. Truly. Yeah, I must say that's just incredible. And that's just a parenthesis for Dave, but my father, who's passed on a long time ago, was such a fan of Rachel's. And I do regret that, he isn't around to know that Rachel and I finally did such a project together and are continue to see each other and play together.
And my guess is that since this is Bach Ascending that you'll be performing at, you may very well perform one or more of these sonatas for violin and harpsichord.
Yeah, Rachel.
Yeah, well, so we're kind of building a program so that you get all the possible combinations of us, which, well, since there's two of us, that means one of us, the other of us, or both of us.
Thank you. Yeah.
So we're beginning and ending the program with two of our favorite of the duo sonatas. Well, there are no bad ones in the set of six,
No.
but we're starting with the dramatic B minor, the first of the set, and then probably the most popular and beloved, the number three in E major is what we'll be finishing off with. And in between,
Very
I'll be
special.
doing the D minor partita with its famous chaconne.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And Jory will be treating us to some solo harpsichord, and I'll let you talk about that piece.
And just to vary a little bit, both to Bach Ascending, to our programs together, and because I have a Scarlatti recording coming out next year, I will be playing six sonatas by Domenico Scarlatti. And of course, wonderful, wonderful keyboard music. And I think they go beautifully with our program. Otherwise, I would not choose to do this. Where on most of the programs that Rachel and I have played together, I play one of the big Bach solo works. I have been generally playing the French Overture, which is the Partita in B minor, but I really wanted to change it up this time.
Well, I'll personally look forward to hearing you play Scarlatti, and anyone who really wants to hear Jory play solo harpsichord works by Bach can, of course, refer to his various albums.
Thank you. As always, I think the public is in for more than a treat. It's not just a treat to hear Rachel play the D minor partita. I've heard her play it now several times, and this never, never, never gets old to me.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, we've recorded all the repertoire that you're about to hear, but there's nothing better than live performance,
No.
especially with multiple artists where we're playing off of each other, and it's never the same every time we come together. It's just something unique in that moment, in that concert space with that audience on that day,
I
and
agree. So,
keeps it always fresh.
and I think I hope that Rachel feels as I do, but now with quite a few years of knowing each other, there is real trust. I don't think necessarily that we're inclined to take crazy risks. We know our pieces very deeply, but we do play off of each other, as you said, Rachel. And I think there's always a spontaneity that the dialogue always feels fresh.
Well, that's one of the great things about being a musician is getting to collaborate with others. And of course, you learn and grow by collaborating with new people that you haven't played with before, and so that you're
Yeah, of
always
course.
continuing to grow. But there is something very special about playing with, the same person or people over a period of years or even decades, because then there becomes this intuition that exists, this intuitive sense of each other, where it's not just two good players who are coming together to play something. It's that the whole becomes greater than the sum of its parts, right?
Thank
That's
you. Yes,
the thing. And
yes.
there's an instinctiveness that actually starts to enter, where we just feel like a unit instead of like our two separate people trying to sense each other. We already are sensing each other, and we become this entity of the two of us together, which is just a magical thing.
It is. I love how you express it. I'm not always so eloquent, but that's a beautiful way of putting it.
This is WRUULP, Savannah, Georgia, 107.5 FM, WRUU.org. We are Savannah Soundings, community radio with global soul.
You're listening to WRUU, your local radio station, for people just like you, hosted by people from your community. The voices you hear are your neighbors, coworkers, and others from the Savannah and Lowcountry area. In other words, WRUU is your community radio station. Please help us by donating whatever you can to help your neighbors and friends stay on the air. Go to WRUU.org and support your local radio station. Any amount is welcomed. Thank you for your support of WRUU.
This portion of WRUU's programming is brought to you by listeners like you and by the American Traditions Collection of Concerts, including the American Traditions Competition Week, featuring 24 of the top singers from around the country from February 16th to the 20th in quarterfinals, semifinals, and finals competitive rounds at Victory North, 2603 Whitaker Street, Savannah. More information and tickets are available at www.atcsavannah.org.
Hi, I'm Ken Burns. I'm thrilled to announce that the first major national film festival exclusively for historical documentaries is happening in Savannah, Georgia, March 4th through 8th. the inaugural Hindsight Film Festival will showcase the kind of films that make you say, I had no idea about the history that connects us all. Go to hindsightfilmfestival.com for more information.
This music is often called classical music, but remember, Mozart, Beethoven, and Liszt were the rock stars of their time, so I simply call it great music. I'm your host, Dave Lake, and join me for four centuries of great music, with new episodes each week on Sundays from 3 to 5 p.m. We also have encores of these episodes on Saturdays from 3 to 5 p.m. from mid-June to early December. Welcome back to Music Local and Sustainable, and I'm your host, Dave Lake. Tonight on Savannah Music Local and Sustainable, I have Rachel Barton Pine, who is completing the hat trick of my talk music programs, because in 2024, she appeared on Contemporary Classics with composer Earl Minnean, talking about his violin concerto. In 2025, she appeared on Evening Eclectic with cellist Brandon Vamos of the Pacifica Quartet, talking about the music of French Impressionists. And tonight, we're here with harpsichordist Jory Vinicourt, talking about Bach and Baroque music, and the fact that they will be both performing at the Bach Ascending Concert here in Savannah coming up this Sunday, February 15th at 4 p.m. at the Congregation Mikveh Israel on Monterey Square here in Savannah. And of course, the wonder of Bach is the counterpoint. And as you mentioned, the communication between the two instruments.
Very intense. And I mean, again, Rachel has spoken about this. I've also spoken about it. These sonatas for very specifically for violin and harpsichord are really trio sonatas. So if we think of the famous trio sonatas for organ, right hand, left hand, the feet, the pedal, these are trio sonatas. Violin, the harpsichord's right hand, the harpsichord's left hand, but this being Bach and nobody else, a number of the movements really do hew to that rule. It's three-part counterpoint, but not always. And I suppose in the two sonatas that we're playing on February 15th, for instance, the E major sonata starts with this fabulous chorale-type movement where the harpsichord is both organ and orchestra playing a very dense harmonic texture over which the violin plays the most ornate and elaborate cantilena. And then other movements really are those fugal contrapuntal displays between Rachel, my right hand, the left hand. And so all of this kind of delightful playing a fugue with two people, or in some cases playing what sounds like a concerto type movement.
Yeah, well, it's amazing how much variety he was able to achieve with these two particular instruments. And
Oh, yeah,
in certain movements, I like to say that I am one third of the duo.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. And, but, it, you know, it's interesting, and I don't think that's a kind of a false modesty from Rachel, but in other movements, and again, I think the most extreme of these is that first adagio of the E major, but where the violin has something quite extraordinary, soaring, post-Corelli type of writing, and the harpsichord occupies another very elaborate role. You could say an equal role, but very, very different.
Well, what's interesting is to really note how these sonatas for violin and harpsichord are so different from all of the other Baroque sonatas that preceded them and existed alongside them in two different ways. First of all, most Baroque sonatas, the melody part, whether it was a violin, a flute, or whatever, you know, it would be a little more simple, a little more bare, so that the artist could extemporaneously add the elaborate ornamentation, you know, the melismas on top of the melody. Mm-hmm. You know, they would never play it stark. They would add extra notes to decorate it. And Bach, totally different than the conventions of the time. He provided the decorations. Now, it's great for us in the 21st century. We don't have to worry about ornamenting. And, you know, for those of us, I, of course, know how to do it. Jory knows how to do it. People who've played a lot of Baroque music, but for people who haven't yet, then it's handed to them on a silver platter with the most perfect taste you could possibly imagine. But it was very odd for the time to not leave room for the artists themselves to add their own touches in that way. So the first movement of the E major is a great example of that, yes. That there's just all this elaboration that he has fully written in with very precise rhythms all the way to 128th notes to make it mathematically fit in. Of course, as in any music, how you shape the notes on the page is your own personal touch, and you can even do that extemporaneously, but you're not really adding notes because you wouldn't decorate the decorations. The other thing, of course, is the harpsichord part.
Yes. And I was going to just jump in.
Yeah. Most keyboard parts with a melody line would have been a bass line, the left-hand part, which could also have been potentially doubled by something like a viola da gamba or a cello. Oh, right. And then the right hand of the harpsichord would be filling in rhythmically and harmonically, you know, depending on the interpretation, but based on the chord symbols, the numbers, what we call figured bass. And so the right hand would have been not notated at all, except by these numbers.
Exact. And Bach does seem to be the first composer who produces some sonatas. So the six for violin and harpsichord. There are, I think, two fully figured ones for flute and harpsichord, which are known to be of his, three viola da gamba and harpsichords. They're very original and innovative at the time. They're the first sonatas for a solo instrument, usually a treble instrument, not always, and a keyboard, where the keyboard is written out. And this leads fairly smoothly to Mozart sonatas, violin and fortepiano, Beethoven, etc. And Bach inspired a number of contemporaneous composers to do like him.
Well, and it's interesting how string players, having the personalities that they do, they consider sonata for violin and piano, it's referred to as a violin sonata. And yet, you know, these early ones, the keyboard part was more full. There's more in it than the violin part. It doesn't mean that the violin part is unimportant, but of course there are examples where the violin part is almost like a little add-on to the keyboard part. That's a different type of thing. But, you know, looking ahead to Beethoven sonatas, well, Mozart sonatas, and even into Beethoven sonatas, they were actually in their original editions called sonatas for like piano with a violin. Just really
so sometimes this feels very disingenuous to me. You know, just attracting the public's attention, the purchaser's attention. But and in many cases, even in some Mozart, and I'm sure you've played them all, Rachel, but in some of the Mozart, it does feel a bit like that is the case.
Yeah, like the piano has the bulk of the substance and the violin is one more part. And I think this goes back to the Bach with you know, left hand, right hand, and violin. It's three entities and
three voices.
So, yep. And so what this really means is that it's not like other things that a violinist might play with a keyboardist, where really the violin part would be more dominant, more important. You know, sometimes, you know, the entire melody is given all to the violin, and the keyboard player could be considered accompaniment. In this case, nobody's accompanying anybody, you know, but it's the fact that with the keyboard, having the ability to play more notes at once and therefore doing so, that the violin has to add itself into the keyboard, if that makes sense. And that's not just in terms of the construct of the music, but even in terms of the sound, you know, the very different sound, the plucked thin strings of the harpsichord, the violin with its ability to speak, but also to sing and sustain, but always playing in such a way that it blends, and that the harpsichord can only do so much. Obviously, Jory is fully exploiting the potential of the sounds that can be created by a harpsichord, especially with a double manual and the different stops and all kinds of tricks of touch. But the violin with its bow has an endless array of articulations at literally at our fingertips. And so I definitely am playing these not just because I have a Baroque violin with its gut strings in my hands, but because I'm playing with a harpsichord and no cello. There's a certain way that I'm creating sound, which is special for these sonatas.
Could you
You very
expand
much so.
upon that, Rachel, in terms of what techniques you use to create that sound, and what sound are you trying to achieve?
Well, again, it goes back to variety, and it really depends on the movement. But if Jory starts dum, bum, ba, da, dum, ba, da, 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 dum, dum, very poised and lively, then I can't come in and go, that would just sound like oil and water and wouldn't be at all satisfying. So sometimes, of course, if like in the first movement of the E major, we keep mentioning that one, but it's so glorious. There I do have a long, sustained, elaborate singing line, and he plays these full rolled chords and things and a walking eighth note pattern. And so there we are contrasting and we lean into the contrast, but then you go into the contrapuntal next movement. He states the material first, and then when I come in, I have to match something of his affect.
Thank you.
Well, and the other genius of Bach is that when he writes sets like this, he writes them all in different keys.
Yeah, I mean, Rachel, I mean, the very interesting thing, and I've not attempted like an analysis in terms of keys of the violin.
Oh gosh, you could go down a rabbit hole where people are coming up with all kinds of mathematical formulas, and then some enterprising people even connect them with religious symbolism, and sometimes it becomes a bit far-fetched.
So for Bach's rare published works here, there are the four sets of keyboard works, the Klavierübungen. The first of these is the six partitas for harpsichord. I think the second is the book comprising the so-called Italian concerto and the French overture, which is actually another partita in B minor. And these are indeed very deliberately constructed, not necessarily to follow a symbolic or meaningful key signature, but simply to touch on the various keys. So, the keyboard partitas, B flat major, C minor, A minor, D major, G major, E minor, going to F for the Italian concerto, F major, and finally B minor for the French overture. This is deliberate, but I don't think there is intended meaning beyond just exploiting the important key signatures. For the six violin and harpsichord sonatas, their history is a bit different. They were known just at the end of Bach's lifetime, if I'm not mistaken, through manuscript sharing, but I don't feel that there is some kind of story or thread going through the key signatures. I don't know what Rachel feels about that, but I haven't thought about it too terribly deeply either.
I mean, my impression has always been, well, I feel like writing one in this key, and I feel like writing one in that key. And he just did whatever he was interested in doing. Now, the choice of keys, of course, each in and of itself is very deliberate, because back at the Baroque, you know, certain keys were associated with certain emotions, certain moods, you know, what they referred to as affect, or even the humors and all of that. And so the E major would not be the same piece if it was transposed to A major. But, you know, we have an A major, which is bright and happy, but more relaxed, whereas the E major is much more extroverted and grand. And that's not an accident. The keys are chosen to match the feelings of the music that the composer is wanting to create. And you know, it's really fascinating to me. Of course, song often gets transposed to fit the range of a voice, and then it becomes a different key. But in instrumental music, where the notes are fixed, you know, composers were very, very cognizant. And so B minor is, again, a different feeling than C minor or A minor.
I do believe that's true. There are a couple of well-ish known examples, for instance, of the sonatas by Bach for flute and harpsichord. The big one is the B minor, great piece, but there's another version for it, which I think Bach intended for organ, and it's the same piece, note for note, in G minor, and it does feel awfully different. And the famous French overture, which I've mentioned a couple of times, in B minor, the earliest version of it, basically the same piece, so some rhythmic changes in C minor. So all of this is true, and yet Bach and other composers could, of course, decide to modify things.
And with, you know, the Baroque violin, it's a much more naturalistic approach to the instrument, which has been in our world since approximately the 1490s. Once it got its metal strings and its longer neck and became modernized at the late 1700s, you know, then we sort of started to think beyond the instrument in a way, you know, playing entire melodies on a single string with lots of shifts to have a uniformity of sound. Playing legato lines that lasted longer than a human voice would need to pause to take a breath. But that was not the aesthetics of the earlier 1700s. And so phrase shapes were supposed to be organic. And the use of the violin, it's not that they weren't physically good enough yet on the instrument to shift around a bunch and to use their fourth finger instead of their open string, but they wanted to hear their beautiful open string with the sound of the gut strings. And complexity was valued over uniformity. And so we wanted the D string to have a different color than the A string or the E string. And so you did a lot of staying in first position just because that was more interesting. And so different keys, of course, have different amounts of open strings depending on how many sharps or flats there are on the notes of the G, D, A, E of the violin. And so even just the resonances that might occur within a violin that is, you know, not cross-tuned but tuned to its usual fifths is different for each key. And of course, with different temperaments, the harpsichord is also not only differently resonating, but certain chords are literally pitched differently than other chords. And I'm talking about chords of the scale, like a 5-chord or a 3-chord or a 7-chord. If you're in different keys, those might be more grinding or more open or different things like that. And that affects the emotion.
Yeah. I mean, the tuning makes such a great difference and is a whole field by itself, of course. It can be discussed for a lifetime.
For those not familiar, you know, the modern piano is tuned to what we call equal temperament, meaning that each of the pitches is equally far apart and all of them equally slightly out of tune. So a perfectly tuned piano is exactly in tune to absolutely nothing. And so with the harpsichord, you have the ability to choose, is your C sharp / D flat going to be a little higher or a little lower today?
Yep. And so certain keys are very pure. And there's a book, Rachel might be aware of it, Dave, you might be too. And I should look up the author, but it's How Equal Temperament Ruined Music.
How Equal Temperament Ruined Harmony and Why You Should Care. Like a terribly esoteric book, but actually it's a wonderfully fun and breezy read. And even my non-professional musician husband enjoyed reading it. It's a slim volume and it explains... Anybody who, you know, paid half a bit of attention to their high school math is going to comprehend what's going on, and I highly recommend it.
That's by Ross Duffin. Ross Duffin, the author.
If you just Google Ross Duffin, Equal Temperament, you're going to find the book, and it's a great purchase.
You will learn something.
And, Jory, again, which of the sonatas by Scarlatti are you going to be performing here in Savannah?
Oh, my gosh. I was hoping you wouldn't ask me, but I think I will be performing A major, which is K208, A minor, K54. I will then play D minor, K517, D major, 145, F sharp minor, unusual key, K447, and finally D major, 535.
Tonight on Savannah Music Local and Sustainable, I have had Rachel Barton Pine, who, as I mentioned before, is now completing the hat trick of my shows, having appeared on both Contemporary Classics and Evening Eclectic prior to tonight's show, and harpsichordist Jory Vinicor, who is new to the program, but hopefully we'll have him back in the future on one of my shows. And again, they will be performing at the Bach Ascending Concert here in Savannah coming up this Sunday, February 15th at 4 p.m. at the Congregation Mikveh Israel on Monterey Square here in Savannah. And I want to thank you so very much, Rachel Barton Pine and Jory Vinicor, for being on the show tonight.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you, Dave. Thank you very much for having us indeed.
This has been another edition of Music Local and Sustainable, and I've been your host, Dave Lake. Save this time for another show next week.
Well, I know we ain't headed for the Hall of Fame. Gonna give it what we got, man, it ain't no shame. Let me know if you can hear me. Check, check, one, two. Let me know if you can hear me. Check, check, one, two.